Welcome to Washington Today for Monday, August 28th, 2023. I'm Gary Sterikoff. Thanks a lot for joining us today. At Federal District Court here in Washington, Judge Tanya Chutkan has set a trial date of March 4th, 2024 for the criminal case against former President Donald Trump, who's charged with attempting to interfere with the results of the 2020 presidential election. That puts the trial square in the middle of next year's presidential primary calendar and could potentially conflict with the former president's other legal troubles. Well, details, we'll have them for you coming up. President Biden has approved a request from Florida Governor Ron DeSantis to declare a state of emergency there as Tropical Storm Idalia approaches. The storm is predicted to intensify and hit the state as a Category 3 hurricane on Wednesday morning. Also today, President Biden is marking the anniversary of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, the day best known in history for Dr. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. The president and vice president talked about the anniversary and the racially motivated mass shootings that happened over the weekend in Jacksonville, Florida. We'll hear what they had to say. And we'll also hear more from this day 60 years ago and about new research that shows post-civil rights era laws have largely failed to address widening racial disparities in wages, wealth, and homeownership for Black Americans. We begin here in Washington, where the attorneys for former President Trump had asked for a 2-year delay for his federal election interference trial. Judge Chutkan denied that request and said she knows that her decision could conflict with Donald Trump's other legal troubles. Writing about that decision, the New York Times said, quote, the district attorney in Fulton County, Georgia, has also proposed taking Mr. Trump to trial on charges of tampering with the election in that state on March 4th as well. Another case in Manhattan, which Mr. Trump has been accused of more than 30 felonies connected to hush money payments to a porn actress in the run-up to the 2016 election, has been scheduled to go to trial on March 25th. That's, again, from the New York Times report. The Times goes on to say, quote, and if the trial in Washington lasts more than 11 weeks, it could bump up against Mr. Trump's other federal trial on charges of illegally retaining classified documents after he left office and obstructing the government's efforts to retrieve them. That trial is scheduled to begin in Florida in late May. You can read more at NewYorkTimes.com. At today's hearing, Judge Chutkan said, quote, Mr. Trump, like any defendant, will have to make the trial date work regardless of his schedule. She added that, quote, there is a societal interest to a speedy trial. Of course, the trial start date comes a day before the Super Tuesday primaries next year. That's when voters in more than a dozen states will head to the polls in the Republican presidential primaries. President Biden and Vice President Harris welcome family members of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and other civil rights leaders to the White House today to mark the 60th anniversary of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom.
Kamala and I wanted to convene this incredible group of civil rights leaders for a simple reason. To thank them and to tell them what they tell us. We know we got a lot more work to do. And also remind them that what they do matters more than I think they even appreciate just how consequential it is. You know, we're speaking about more this evening. I'm going to be talking and when we speak in a longer forum. But the bottom line is a lot's happening around things you wouldn't think would be happening today on the anniversary of the 60 years of March. I've spoken to the governor and the mayor and Black community leaders in Jacksonville, Florida. The sheriff was an African-American. I spent a significant amount of time speaking to everyone, including the governor of Florida. And as I've said to the country, we can't let hate prevail. And it's on the rise. It's not diminishing. Silence, I believe, as we've all said many times, silence is complicity. And we're not going to remain silent. And so we have to act against this hate-fueled violence, and you saw what's happening. That, by the way, almost 5 years to the day that five young Blacks were killed in Jacksonville, 5 years earlier, at a store they were doing kids' toys. And we have to speak out that there's a whole group of extreme people trying to erase history, trying to walk away from. I mean, the idea that we're sitting here I never thought that I'd be president, let alone be president, and having a discussion on why books are being banned in American schools. And as administration, we're going to continue to march forward. Jobs and freedom that we've worked so hard for, this group has worked harder than anybody for, and we're going to get it done. So I want to thank the group for their leadership and their partnership, and I want to turn this over to the Vice President for a few minutes, and then we'll get moving.
Thank you, Mr. President. Our country was founded on many noble principles, including e pluribus unum, out of many one. And to live up to those ideals, I think at this moment in time, requires moral clarity on behalf of every American about what is at stake right now. The vast majority of us have so much more in common than what separates us. Yet there are those who are intentionally trying to divide us as a nation. And I believe each of us has a duty to not allow factions to sever our unity. Our diversity is our strength, and our unity is our power as a nation. And I do believe that we must be guided by knowing that we have so much more in common than what separates us. We must be committed to building communities, building coalitions, understanding that is how we strengthen ourselves as a nation. And the members of the King family are here. Ambassador Andy Young is here. I'm gonna, if I may, for the children of Coretta Scott King, paraphrase something she said, which is that the fight for civil rights, for justice, for equality must be fought in one with each generation. We have Yolanda King here, who epitomizes that understanding, that it is incumbent on each of us at this moment in time in our country to stand for the sake of unity and foundational principles that out of many, we are one. Thank you, Mr. President.
Mr. President, as we have laws, we have policies, you have executive orders. Mr. President, how do you prevent this hate? Is it a hard issue? How do you intend to stop this hate that you just said? Sir, by talking directly to the American people, because I think the vast majority of the American people agree with this table. But we have to understand this is serious. I said a little earlier when I came in and sat down, I think this is as serious a potential turning point for the negative as it was when the turning point for the positive when your dad organized that march. I really think this is a critical time. We have groups, a significant minority, but I think they want to change the direction that we've been working on so hard and making such significant progress on for so long. We can't let it happen. We just have to speak to it.
Sir, do you plan to travel to Mexico? Have you spoken with any of the families of the victims?
This is the last thing I'll speak to and get this moving. I've spoken to the authorities in Jacksonville, and I've even spoke to the governor as well last night for some time, all the folks. And right now, I asked for whether or not it was appropriate for the local people to contact the families. Two of them are prepared to be contacted. One does not want to be contacted. I'm letting this just let things settle because, you know, everybody deals with profound loss in a different way. And it's important that, I know from experience, it's important to try to do it in a way that is most helpful and eases the anxiety the most. So I haven't spoken to them yet. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Thank you.
Earlier today at the White House and more on the Jacksonville shootings, Attorney General Merrick Garland said yesterday that the Justice Department is investigating them as a, quote, hate crime and an act of racially motivated violent extremism. Jacksonville Sheriff T.K. Waters told CNN that, quote, there's no question the killings were racially motivated. He added that the shooter made it clear in racist writings he left before launching the attack, that, quote, he hated blacks, and I think he hated just about everyone that wasn't white. That's a quote from Jacksonville, Florida Sheriff T.K. Waters talking to CNN. And the latest on Tropical Storm Idalia now, the National Hurricane Center is saying the storm could be the strongest to hit Florida's Big Bend area since 1950 and could result in, quote, life-threatening storm surge. And earlier today, President Biden told Florida Governor Ron DeSantis in a phone call that he has approved the governor's state request for a state of emergency. That allows the Department of Homeland Security and Federal Emergency Management Agency to coordinate disaster relief efforts in over 30 counties. According to the White House, the president also pledged his full support for the people of Jacksonville, where three African Americans were killed in that attack over the weekend. With more, here's White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre.
They kept it to what the readout was. Clearly, we always are very careful not to read out private conversation. They talked about clearly about the president offering any assistance that the governor might need as we are talking about the Jacksonville shooting, as you all know, and also the storm Idalia that's headed to Florida. That is kind of clearly what's on everybody's mind as we see this potential Category 3 storm. And as a community is mourning, I don't have anything else to read out from that call, but clearly those are the two pertinent things at the moment that they were able to discuss. And the president wanted to make sure that that not just the governor, but the people of Florida knew and understood that the president, the federal government is with them through the different kind of events that they're dealing with at this time.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre, you can see the whole briefing at cspan.org. Finally, today is the 60th anniversary of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, and there's a new report out that found post-Civil Rights era legislation has largely failed to address widening racial disparities in wages, wealth, and homeownership for Black Americans. We talked to one of the report's authors today, Adewale Maye, who is a policy and research analyst at the Economic Policy Institute, about where those laws may have fallen short.
The civil rights legislation, the civil rights era, the movement as a whole succeeded in removing key barriers to equal rights under the law. But to what I was saying, many of the economic demands were left unmet. Failure to address these have adversely impacted the economic security of people of color and exacerbated many of the longstanding racial disparities in economic outcomes present today. So, for example, while we do have the right to vote, we know that voter suppression is rampant in many parts of the country. We see many ways in which politicians are disempowering voters of color and Black voters in particular from exercising that right to vote. We know that home ownership continues to be a problem. Wealth continues to be a problem, with many Black families having negative wealth. Wages and income disparities have grown more disparate over time. So we're seeing that many of the things that were advocated for during the march are still things that we're striving for today.
You in your report, you provide a very, very clear graphic that on Black unemployment consistently higher than unemployment of any other racial or ethnic group. And your research going all the way back to the 1970s. Clearly a big dip in unemployment among all classes here during the Trump administration, the spike at COVID and the drop again now during the Biden administration. Why has that line tracked consistently higher for the Black population?
I think that also kind of goes into some of the structural structural racism that's present within our economy. So Black workers are often employed, or more likely to be employed, in sectors or jobs that are given low wages. Because of that, during economic downturns, they face some of the most disparate outcomes, whether that's unemployment, and that there are even other things like occupational segregation, for example, that are also structural and systemic, that provide barriers or inhibit Black workers from having that safety net during those economic downturns, those recessions. So as a point, Black workers and other workers of color tend to face higher unemployment rates than white workers who do not have those factors.
Headline from The Hill, thehill.com, Black workers comprise 90% of recent unemployment spike, the data show. Adewale Amaye, what impact has the increasing number of immigrants in this country had on black unemployment and blacks' ability to get jobs?
I'm not sure how much immigration as a whole has played into that. The systemic and structural barriers or that even has affected racial wage gaps, unemployment, are due to a combination of factors. I would include stagnant minimum wage, falling union coverage being another one, occupational segregation, as I said, but also just discrimination in hiring and pay and inequitable pathways to promotion.
You have a chart showing that the black white median wage gap has widened since 1979. What does this mean exactly, the wage gap? How should we look at this information?
So the wage gap is basically the wages, it's a ratio of what a typical white worker is making and a black worker is making. So regarding wages, a typical black worker is paid 23.4% less per hour than a typical white worker. And racial wage gaps have persisted from the 1960s to the present, highlighting enduring inequities within the labor market as a whole.
Do you look at job to job? Do you look at specific jobs that are specific industries where black and white, the black worker is making less than the white worker in that industry, in that specific job?
I didn't look at specific industries, but the statistic that I just gave you with the typical black worker is the average across all industries.
In terms of home ownership, you look at that as well. Black home ownership rates grew significantly from 1940 to 1980, but started to drop after 1980. What's going on there? Why'd that happen?
I believe that there were policies, for example, in place during that time. As I said, like right after the civil rights, there was a slight gains, I would say, slight gains in many of the things that were happening, whether it was employment, obviously due to some of those barriers being brought down, and also home ownership. However, the progress that was even during that time wasn't able to be sustained. I think the legacy of redlining and other discriminatory policies like the exclusionary zoning have kept Black families from achieving broad home ownership, building wealth, and obviously accessing affordable housing as well.
Do the legacies of those policies of redlining, of zoning, exclusionary zoning in particular, do those still exist today?
Yeah, absolutely. A colleague of mine and I, we did another research paper about a year ago where we were trying to understand the housing shortage that exists today. And the reason, one of the main contributing factors for that housing shortage is because of policies like exclusionary zoning, which are in place where you can't build other houses. Those have roots within obviously redlining and other discriminatory policies that have existed 60, 70, 80 years ago, and has led to the broad, inaccessible, and unaffordable housing crisis that we're in today.
Adewale Male, who is a policy and research analyst at the Economic Policy Institute on today's Washington Journal. You can see more from him at cspan.org/Washington Journal and the C-SPAN Now mobile app. Of course, the day 60 years ago, best known for Dr. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. But Americans from all walks of life came here to D.C., more than 250,000 of them, for the event. And here's an interview with one of them, done back then by WGBH Radio.
This is David Edwards at the foot of the Lincoln Memorial. With me is Marlon Brando, the world-renowned movie actor. Mr. Brando, can you tell me why you're here today?
I think, yes, I can tell you why we're here. I can speak for myself as a private citizen. All of us from Hollywood have come as a private citizen, representing no group, no political party, and no specific point of view. We're here as Americans to give the full support that we can in every way to the legislation that is now pending before Congress, because we believe it to be right.
Would you go beyond that and support the direct action projects undertaken by especially students, Negro and white, in the South today?
I think that any action that is lawfully provided for by the Constitution is something that should be fully supported and should be participated in. Those are my own views.
And Dr. King wasn't the only speaker at this event. Here's some of what John Lewis, then head of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, had to say.
My friends, let us not forget that we are involved in a serious social revolution. But by and large, American politics is dominated by politicians who build their career on immoral compromising and allow themselves an open form of political, economic, and social exploitation. There are exceptions, of course. We salute those. But what political leader can stand up and say, my party is the party of principles? For the party of Kennedy is also the party of Eastland. The party of Javits is also the party of Goldwater. Where is our party? Where is the political party that will make it unnecessary to march on Washington? Where is the political party that would make it unnecessary to march in the streets of Birmingham? Where is the political party that will protect the citizens of Albany, Georgia? Do you know that in Albany, Georgia, 9 of our leaders have been indicted not by the Dixiecrats, but by the federal government for peaceful protests? But what did the federal government do when Albany Deputy Sheriff beat Attorney C.B. King and left him half dead? What did the federal government do when local police officials kicked and assaulted the pregnant wife of Slater King and she lost her baby? Those who have said be patient and wait, we must say that we cannot be patient. We do not want our freedom gradually, but we want to be free now.
Of course, John Lewis would go on to serve more than 30 years as a U.S. congressman from Georgia and earn several accolades. He passed away in 2020. And you can hear more from that day in two episodes of our Presidential Recordings podcast, including Oval Office conversations between March leaders, President John F. Kennedy, and Vice President Lyndon Johnson. You can find Presidential Recordings at cspan.org/podcast. You can also find it on the podcast tab of our free C-SPAN Now mobile app or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. That's also where you can get this program as a podcast. You can also see it on YouTube. Just search Washington Today. And you can get more on the stories that are shaping Washington every day with our Word for Word newsletter. Just go to cspan.org/connect to subscribe to that. I'm Gary Sterikoff. Thanks a lot for listening today to Washington Today.